Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. Most people these days feel hopeless and cynical about getting government to work for all the people, not just the wealthy. Fruits of economic growth seem to overwhelmingly go to the top 1%, while middle-class incomes have been stagnant and falling, and poverty continues. Can the voice of the people be heard? Can the middle class enjoy more of the fruits of economic growth? Can we get government to act quickly enough on global climate change? Can poverty be eliminated? Here to discuss these and other issues with us today is our guest, author and activist Sam Daly Harris. Mr. Daly Harris founded the anti-poverty lobby group called Results in 1980. He also co-founded the Microcredit Summit Campaign in 1995 with Muhammad Yunus. Most recently, he founded the Center for Citizen Empowerment and Transformation in 2012. Ashoka founder Bill Drayton called him one of the great certified social entrepreneurs of the last decades. He recently released the 20th anniversary edition of his book, Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Government. Sam Daly Harris, welcome to All Together Now.
It's great to be with you.
So tell us about the first organization you founded, Results. Kind of, you know, why did you found it and what did you want it to do?
Well, it was a really interesting journey even up to that moment. You see, I have bachelor's degree and master's degree in music, and I played percussion instruments in the Miami Philharmonic Orchestra in Florida for 12 years, and then I founded Results, which is an anti-poverty lobby. What was that about?
And when I look
when I look back in my life, I see a couple of incidents. I graduated from high school a long time ago in 64. And learned at the ceremony that a high school friend had died the day before in a tractor-trailer accident. And 4 years later, 1968, college graduation, Robert Kennedy was assassinated the night before. And both of these incidents got me to asking, what is this life? What is this death? Why am I here? What am I here to do? And 9 years later, I'm still asking this question. I go to a presentation on ending world hunger, put on by the Hunger Project, and I go to this thing, I would say, as a normal person, meaning I didn't think about it much, thinking that, well, hunger must be just inevitable because there are no solutions, because if there were solutions, somebody would have done something by now. But I go to this thing and I realize right away that there's no mystery to growing food or clean water or basic health. None of that stuff is mysterious. I'm not hopeless about the perceived lack of solutions. I'm hopeless about human nature. People will just never not get around to doing the things that can be done. Well, there's one human nature I have some control over, my own, and my questions. Why am I here? What am I here to do? So I get involved, and this is the end of the story. In 1978 and 79, I speak to 7,000 high school students in Miami, where I lived, in Los Angeles, where I moved. And before going into the first classroom, I read some statements from the National Academy of Sciences, Food and Nutrition Study, and others that call for the political will to end hunger. So I asked 7,000 high school students what the name of their member of Congress was. I didn't want to know if they wrote him. I didn't want to know if they met him. Just the name. Any guesses as to how many out of 7,000 could just tell me the name of their
These
member?
Are high school students or college students?
High school.
I would say probably very few. They're probably going to know the latest rock band more than they'll know the name of their congressman.
So 200 knew, fewer than 3%. 6,800 didn't know, just over 97%. And Results started out of this gap between the calls for the political will to end hunger on the one hand and the lack of basic information on who represented us in Washington on the other. So it's an odd journey from music to anti-poverty lobbying, but that's how it went.
Oh, I think it's a wonderful journey, and I wish, you know, more people would make that kind of a shift. And you don't have to give up music to be an advocate in politics. So I hope you have music as a big part of your life.
I do.
That's great. So, yes, there is definitely that gap. It's astonishing to me how little people know about the government, you know, who is your member of Congress, who's in the House, who, or even that there is a House and a Senate.
Well, if I could just update that story for a second.
Yeah.
A year and a half ago, I was on this book tour, and I spoke on 15 college campuses. The LBJ School at the University of Texas, the Hubert Humphrey Institute, University of Minnesota, Oberlin College. I tell the students this story from 35 years ago, and then I ask them 35 years later what the name of their member of Congress was. Now, this is college. 35 years later, 10% can answer correctly. 90% still can't tell me. So that's kind of a little update from my original story. So,
yeah, and that's probably that 10% who know is probably higher than the average bearer of the 75% of people who don't go to college.
Yeah,
so,
no, absolutely.
You're talking among the most educated populations there.
Sure, of their age, yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, to a certain extent, the the wealthy elites who tend to dominate our political system thrive on that lack of knowledge. And, in fact, you know, some think there's active efforts to discourage them knowing that or being engaged.
Yeah, absolutely. If I could tell you this one story from last year, I was speaking at Rutgers. And before the lecture, I met with small groups of students around tables. I get to the last table. They introduce themselves. The last questioner, he says, "I'm in an honors futures class. With a view to 50 years in the future, what's the most important issue we could work on?" I said, "Well, my friends in climate change tell me if we don't deal with that, we're toast. And my friends in campaign finance reform say if we don't fix that, nothing will change. And my friends in global poverty tell me it's a blight on humanity. But for me, the most important issue is why so few of us see ourselves as change makers. Mm-hmm. If we could fix that one, there would be this barrage of people kind of getting up the couch and moving into all these different issues." So, yeah, that's kind of the place that I work in.
Yeah, that's great. And so you found the results in 1980, which is 35 years ago.
Yes.
And it was against poverty. We've made some gains, but we still have that kind of pernicious poverty. We saw kind of exploding in fact, not only that there's poverty, but a sense that it's never going to change. And I think that's the worst part of it when you look at a place like Baltimore, where, you know, there's poverty. There was always, you know, we've always had poor people, but now it feels like there's no sense of hope that it's going to change. What do you think has improved in the 35 years you've been at this?
Well, let me answer it two different ways. One way is my attention when I was with Results was particularly on the global aspect, and then we'll get to the Baltimore aspect secondarily. So when we started lobbying first in 1984 on child and maternal health programs, vaccinating kids against measles and oral rehydration therapy to prevent dehydration and the like, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, reported that 41,000 children around the world were dying every day.
41,000 a day?
Yes, from largely preventable, underline the word preventable, malnutrition and disease. Now, Results lobbied for 30 years, every year, like 87, 88, 80, every year. And the latest number from UNICEF is that the number's gone from 41,000 a day worldwide to 17,000 a day. Now, the UN's going to have its big gathering in September and come up with the post-millennium development goals. And I think the new goal will be something like zero preventable death.
That's a good goal.
Just
now, is this children or this is all people?
This is children under five. mm-hmm. zero deaths a day from preventable malnutrition and disease. The date will be 2030 or 2035. Now, just because they said it doesn't mean we'll achieve it. Mm-hmm. Meaning, depending on how asleep the public continues to be, but still, there's some real progress. Let me give you one other example. We started lobbying in mid-80s on basic education, and at that time, around the world, there were 150 million children of elementary school age who were not in school, meaning they were 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, and 150 million were not in school. Today, the latest number is at 58 million around the world. It sounds crazy, but it's progress, but it's crazy that 58 million children around the world who are elementary school age are not in school. So it's real progress. Now, I'm expecting that when they set the post-millennium development goals in September and announce them, I expect that there'll be a similar kind of zero goal. I'm not sure if the year will be 2030 or 2035. So you can see real progress. And I would argue that if you went out on the street, you know, child deaths around the world gone up or down, people will say, well, no, it's getting worse, which is not right. Kids out of school around the world, more out of school or fewer? Oh, no, it's getting worse. The world's going to hell in a handbasket. Yeah, you know, the news is often the loud emergencies, the earthquakes and the famines and the like. But still, I think most people don't know that progress is being made. Whether it's fast enough, surely that not. But
right. Well, I think that's certainly true. And as you may know, I wrote a book on breakthrough solutions, and that, you know, very much make that point that the media tends to so focus on what's wrong and what's yeah. breaking down that they're not focusing on what's right and what's breaking through.
Right.
And for some reason, they think good news doesn't sell. But I think people are so kind of discouraged and depressed now, when in fact there's a lot that we can celebrate and that we can learn from and build on.
Well, you know, and maybe we'll get to this part a little later and go back to Baltimore. But one of the things I work on now is coaching organizations on training their members to get things in the news that ought to be in the news, to not bemoan the fact that you can't see the victories and the next steps because they're always covering the tragedy, but
yeah.
you be the one who gets the letters to the editor, the op-eds, or whatever in the news.
I definitely want to talk about media, but before yeah. we do that, let's stay on this issue
yes.
of poverty for a while, because
well,
I think if you look, you know, you're talking globally. If you look at the United States,
yeah.
we
yeah.
actually had some very good progress, I think, with you and some of the other people doing important work out there, that we actually had brought poverty down in the
mm-hmm.
1970s.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, some of the programs that had worked had budget cuts and or
yes.
were stopped.
Yes,
and that
yes.
there's been a rise now again.
Yeah.
So actually, we had made progress, and now we're going backwards, and there's something like 50 million people in the United States, the richest country
yeah.
in the world, and we have people kind of backsliding with 50 million people either poor or on the edge of poverty. So what happened there, and what do we need to do to really keep our progress steady?
Let me focus on your second half of the question. And what, you know, my work is, I don't deliver vaccinations, or I don't deliver a good school or a good teacher. My work is in advocacy, advocating
mm-hmm.
for. So a lot of my questions are around what's working that we're not fully implementing, and what's not working that we are implementing. So I always look at those questions. And when I look at a Baltimore, let me tell you one thing I think of. I had a Skype conversation two nights ago with a woman in Australia who'd been introduced to me by a friend in England, and both of them work on what is from prenatal care through elementary school kind of work with at-risk families. So they make sure that if there's a young woman, a young family that's at risk and pregnant, that they get the right kind of prenatal care and they get the right kind of visits from nurses and whatever, and, you know, so that when their children are born, they're born into a family that's clearer about what works the best, how to care for children, how to love children, how to read to children. So this is a kind of program, because when the U.S. often thinks about early childhood, we think pre-K or kindergarten or something. But it has to start much earlier. And when it does, I think maybe you've heard of like the Harlem Children's Zone, mm-hmm. as one example of a kind of program in the U.S. that attempts to get to that earliest moments of prenatal care and birth and infancy and all of those years. So that's a kind of intervention that, when done right, can really help breakthroughs. And that's something we would need to focus on more. Let me give you another example. I work with a group called the Peace Alliance, and one of the pieces of legislation that they're working on right now, I'm sad to say most people probably haven't heard of it, and it's something that works, is the Youth Promise Act. And the Youth Promise Act would fund violence prevention programs in communities all around the United States. And so what are the kind of activities and the kinds of programs that, if we're implemented, you know, they actually have measurable impacts on preventing violence, kind of thing. Another example, I'll give you one more, of something that we're doing that doesn't work and we need to stop doing it, kind of thing. And is this everything related to mass incarceration, mm-hmm. And all the numbers surrounding that? You know, at some level, when so many members of a community are incarcerated or somehow in the penal system, you know, the number of broken relationships and the damage that does to communities is very high. And so I know there's legislation, I'm not with a group that's working on it right now, but I'm excited about it, but introduced by Cory Booker and Rand Paul, which I guess a bit of odd bedfellows, which I love, that would reduce this mandatory sentencing for nonviolent crimes. These are some of the kind of undergirding kinds of ideas and interventions and programs that need to be lifted up. The whole thing of reducing mass incarceration, the whole thing of violence prevention programs, and everything related to starting with at-risk families when the children are prenatal, in utero kind of thing, and beyond. And not stopping when the baby comes out, but continuing with the coaching and the visitations and the like.
Right, exactly. Well, and you're talking about the need to stop what isn't working, right on with stopping the mass incarceration. I mean, it's just so expensive, among other things, and jamming our jails and ruining lives. And you look at the hundreds of thousands of arrests there have been in the past decade or so in Baltimore. It's just, you know, and people being brought in for not doing anything wrong.
When I was watching this program on C-SPAN recently with a professor from Johns Hopkins, and he was saying, if you look at the Baltimore City County budget, the budget for parks and recreation, which is youth programs and youth centers and improving parks and some of those activities, has stayed the same. And the budget for policing has quadrupled over the same period. And so, and a lot of that is based on keeping communities down and the like. So we need to take a look at all these issues. And what excites me is that my work is not letting people stick with woe is me, I'm just one person, what can I do about it, I can't make a difference, to wow, I'm in this organization, whichever it is, that's really helping me feel my power and be more empowered and make a difference I've always dreamed of making.
Right, exactly. Well, and, you know, working together in a transpartisan way, we can get a lot of those results and changes. I mean, and I'm just so excited to see Van Jones, our green jobs leader, getting together with Newt Gingrich, the Republican nemesis, and working on this issue to stop mass incarceration. And Newt Gingrich comes at it from the point of view, this is a waste of the public treasury and a waste of lives. And Actually, yep. I saw Van Jones that night at a celebration dinner after he had had the day-long conference bringing together the Newt Gingrich and the Cory Booker, and it was, I think, the Koch brothers certainly had been involved in funding it, if not being there. So, you know, when you start focusing on some of the things we're doing and bring together some strange bedfellows, you know, we can do anything. And I'm convinced we can solve every problem in the country, that someone somewhere already has the solution. We just need to focus on it, realize it, and get in gear and make sure that it happens.
Well, the way I usually say it is, if everyone were involved, there wouldn't be enough problems to go around.
Oh, I look forward to that day.
Exactly.
So, you know, you wrote this book telling the story of results and the amazing work you did there called Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Government. And you've just come out with now the 20th anniversary edition of the book. You know, and I'm hearing, you know, when I'm listening to some other interviews you've done, that people hear the title, Reclaiming Our Democracy, and they actually break into laughter. So, you know, what is the basic message of your book? How do you say we reclaim our democracy?
Well, okay, so the basic messages are three. Number one, most people feel hopeless and cynical about making a difference with their voice as a citizen. Number two, for the last 35 years, I've seen people make a profound difference using their voice as a citizen. And number three, which is the toughie, you have to find an organization that provides a deep structure of support, that provides more than kindergarten. Most organizations keep us in kindergarten. Click here. Click here to make a donation. Click here to sign the petition. There's nothing wrong with that. We could do that. But we need to know, and we do know, that that's important kindergarten work. You have to find an organization that takes you to third grade, fifth, ninth, 12th, and beyond as a citizen. And so that's the message of the book. And the book is mostly about the third point, organizations, results, and citizen climate lobby, and now others that have that deeper structure of support. Let me give you this one story. I have, when I do talks, I have this list of NGO, non-governmental organization attitudes that kill citizen empowerment and transformation. So I put the first two attitudes that kill citizen empowerment up on a slide. I was in England. I was at an NGO, a non-governmental group that has 700 staff in the head office. I was only a dozen of the campaigners. I put these first two on the board, and a woman says, "That's us. That's us. Number two, that's us." And number two is, we can't have our volunteers write letters to the editor or op-eds because they'll get it wrong and misrepresent the organization.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Well, wait a minute. Wait. So I had gotten that attitude. These are verbatim, all these on my little list, from their sister organization in the United States. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, we can't have them. They'll get it wrong and misrepresent. I said, yeah, if you give them a kindergarten curriculum and you ask them to write a letter to the editor, they'll get it wrong. But if you give something richer than that, they won't get it wrong. And they said, well, you know, we have 15 media staff at head office. They take care of the media. I said, well, yeah, you mean the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, USA Today. Who's connecting with the Salt Lake Tribune and the Miami Herald? That's where Congress is. They're not covering those newspapers. So anyway, I just played off of that whole kindergarten thing, which is...
Yeah. Well, you know, and at the same time, we know that people are incredibly busy. So if you get something like a moveon.org that says, you know, click here and sign your name and we'll bring the 10,000 petitions in to get this change.
Right.
You know, that's a valuable service. But I hear what you're saying. We can't stop there. We need to have people really involved, particularly now, you know, where our very republic is threatened by the flood of the right-wing money. We need the citizens to really be citizens and not leave it to the professionals, whoever they may be, to take care of it.
And said another way, the money only works if we're asleep.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, I need money to get elected and run these ads, and I get this money and I run these ads, I get elected, and then everyone can go back to sleep. I'm not running any ads anymore. And now I'll raise some more money to run these ads to get reelected. But if we were awake, the ads wouldn't work. I mean, we'd be paying attention and the like. On this same topic, Paul Loeb, who wrote The Soul of a Citizen, said to me about 2 years ago, he said, you know those e-blast petitions to Congress? They're counted, but they're also discounted. And I think he meant, you know, well, they're counted, but they're also discounted because all they did was click the box and that was it. And so there's some level to which they're discounted also.
Right. And, you know, then there is the hierarchy of impact of what you're doing, that the click is the first, and then, you know, on up the chain of writing your own letter up to let's talk to the staff of the member of Congress.
Yeah, and the member himself or herself. And my thing is, don't stop clicking. Just don't stop there.
Right. And that can be a doorway into doing more when you see the impact that can have.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we had talked before a little bit about the media, which is just so crucial in terms of getting a message out these days. And you've been aware of this since the beginning of your work. And you talk about how the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Muhammad Yunus, who, you know, wrote the foreword to your book, tells about the conference call you set up for him with 28 editorial writers before he was a known entity. So how did you get these editorial writers from major papers to join the call with someone who was an unknown?
Well, the answer is I didn't get them. The volunteers got. Now, listen to this piece. Muhammad, this is 19 years before he received the Nobel Peace Prize, 1987.
Mm-hmm.
So here's this unknown guy doing an unknown intervention. Microfinance was not known in 1987, from a very little discussed country, Bangladesh. And there are 28 editorial writers, 14 the first hour and 14 the second hour, on a call with them. And it's really all the volunteers who are, you know, calling in January and they can't get through, and calling in February, and they get a second with the editorial writer by mistake. They thought it was someone else calling and say, can you send something? And they send a packet in, and they call again in March, and they call again, you know.
What are they calling about?
Well, they're calling about this new bill on microfinance in 1987. You know, and the editorial writer said, I'm not going to, can we have 10 minutes meeting for coffee? And they meet, and the editorial writer says, I'm not going to write on this. Why don't you write an op-ed for the paper? And so they write their op-ed, and you know, eventually, months later, they find out that Muhammad Yunus is going to be on this call, and they tell their editorial writer, who they've been, shall I say, pestering for 7 months, you know, and the editorial writer says, okay, well, when is it? Let me see if I can fit it in my schedule. So it was volunteers who were being on conference calls once a month with a guest speaker and Q&A and hearing some other grassroots victories around the country, and in January and February and March and April, becoming really local spokespersons in this particular intervention. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who 19 years before he received the Nobel Peace Prize got Muhammad Yunus, who was this unknown guy to everybody else, but not unknown to the editorial writers who jumped on the call.
That's really great. And then was it 60 Minutes that heard about
First call, there was a woman on. Her name was Kristen Helmore from the Christian Science Monitor. She said, can I be on the second call too? I said, sure, but don't ask questions. Let the new 14 ask the questions. So she's on the second call, too, and she writes a four-part series in the Christian Science Monitor on microfinance, Muhammad Yunus, and CBS 60 Minutes reads the article, and out of that does their own research and decides to go there in 89 to do a segment, which they aired twice in 1990. And those were the days where you didn't have 900 TV channels. You didn't have MSNBC or Fox News or any of the others, so much of the other stuff. So when it was on 60 Minutes in 1990, it was an even bigger deal because more people were watching and the like. So, yeah, it's quite remarkable what can come about.
Yeah, that's a great story. And so much of that is still what happens. You know, the newspapers, even though a lot of them are shrinking or going out of business, that still a lot of the television and cable, you know, there's that constant drive now looking for material, and a lot of the material from cable or television still comes out of the newsprint story. So,
And people complain, well, come on, who's reading the newspaper anymore? Well, and I'll say, well, yeah, they're not running to the front yard maybe to read the newspaper, but if you're a member of Congress from Portland, Oregon, and you're in Washington, D.C., where's the first place you look to find out what's going on in the community? You could look to some Oregon blogger, that'd be fine, but you probably will look to the Oregonian newspaper to check out what the conversation is back home while you're in D.C. So for our targets, the members of Congress, it's still a key piece of the pie.
Yeah, and I think that's great. And for all our listeners out there looking, you know, what can you do, that's certainly something you can do, is be connected with your local and regional media and ask them to tell you stories about what's working and not just what's breaking down and what's not working.
Yeah.
So, and that's some of what you're doing now, right? You've got the Citizens Climate Lobby, which is a group obviously working on the climate change challenge, and you've been coaching them for 7 years. So now talk about a big challenge to take on.
Right.
What are you advising them to do, and what kind of results are they getting?
I coached them for 7 years. And that ended about a year ago. They turned 7 last October. And let me tell you quickly how they started. Marshall Saunders is the founder. He was a volunteer in results. And he called me up and he said, I saw Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth 3 times in 10 days. And then I went to Nashville, 1 of the 1,000 to be trained to lead the slideshow. I went home to San Diego. I led it for 43 times. But early on, I realized I was giving people 98% the problem and 2% what they could do about it.
Exactly.
And he said they couldn't buy enough Priuses or change enough light bulbs to make up for what the government was or wasn't doing. He said even one day, I was reading the paper, the San Diego Union Tribune, with my cup of coffee in one hand, and I saw an article that Congress had appropriated $18 billion in fossil fuel subsidies. And I'd gotten 18 light bulbs changed that day.
Right.
He said, this is never going to work.
Right.
So he said, called me up. He said, will you coach me in starting Citizens Climate Lobby? We talked in July of 07. He launched the first chapters in October of 07. They turned 7 last October. Last year, their volunteers in the U.S. and Canada had 2,253 letters to the editor published, up from 36 in 2010. Last year, they had 291 op-eds published, up opposite the editorial page opinion columns, 291, up from 20 in 2010. And last year, they had 1,086 meetings with members of Congress, Canadian Parliament, or their staff, 1,086, up from 106 in 2010. That is some really astounding examples of grassroots breakthroughs. I mean, there's a drawing in the new edition of the book where on one side of the page is a small circle that's labeled your comfort zone. And to the right is a much larger circle that's labeled where the magic happens. And the trick is finding an organization that can help you move out of your comfort zone and over to where the magic happens. And the magic is, I'm so worried about climate change. It's a really big problem. My voice doesn't matter. And then the magic is, you know, your letter's been published twice in the local paper, and you've sent it to your member of Congress, House and Senate, kind of thing, and you've arranged a meeting with them to talk about it. That's magic, coming from, I don't make a difference, they'll never listen to me, kind of thing. And so, yeah, it's very exciting what they've been able to pull off. And you know, you mentioned, you know, people can go out and reach out to their papers and ask them to cover what they want to, what they're longing to see and read and hear, kind of thing. But the trick goes back to my point three. The challenge is finding an organization that provides a deep enough structure of support that's really empowering and moves you out of kindergarten and way beyond. So in that sense, I would urge people, go ahead.
Yeah, and, you know, you talk about the thousands with the letters to the editor and the meetings with Congress members, and I know some people dismiss that and say, well, you know, so what difference does that make? But, you know, I've worked with these elected officials at the state and also at the U.S. Capitol. In fact, I was there at the Capitol yesterday at a press conference for women and getting equal pay for equal work and some of the other issues of concern for women. And Leader Nancy Pelosi was there and a number of members of Congress. And they said, look, you know, we're doing what we can inside Congress, but for this institution, meaning the U.S. Congress, to work and to change and to do something, it takes pressure from the outside. And it was the members of Congress who are asking us, the advocates, to please write to your members of Congress, call them, visit them, put pressure on them so they know what it is you want them to do. And I think sometimes people feel so disempowered they don't bother to do it, and then that leaves the field open to the lobbyists for the oil companies and the pharmaceuticals to have a free reign.
Exactly. I think, was it President Johnson who said, I agree with you. Now go out and make me do it.
Right, FDR.
Right. And, you know, and there's a great quote from Apollo astronaut Rusty Schweikert who said, we aren't passengers on spaceship Earth. We're the crew. We aren't residents on this planet. We're citizens. The difference in both cases is responsibility. And that can be a burden or it can be a joy, and I go for the joy part.
Right, absolutely. And so what advice do you have in terms of talking to people who don't think about you? Say someone is going to write to their member of Congress or that they're elected, but now there's, you know, our audience is very progressive, generally Democratic or left Democratic. And a lot of the people who are in state and federal office now are Republican.
Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of times people say, well, I'm not even going to bother to talk with them. They don't really, they don't agree with me. They have a different worldview. So what's your advice of how you get a conversation going that's productive with someone who you think comes from a totally different worldview?
Well, first of all, you have to actually be committed to that. You have to be committed to getting something productive rather than committed to having a good fight, kind of thing. And if you're committed to getting something productive, then you need to find something that you can thank them for or something where you're on the same wavelength, kind of thing. And I have this, I did a talk at College of St. Benedict, St. John's University in Minnesota a year and a half ago. And before the lecture, there was a book group, and it was students, faculty, and staff. And there was a nun who had just retired as 37 years as a librarian. And she said, I love, you know, what you were saying. I love all this stuff, but I don't know what to do. My member of Congress, this was a year and a half ago, is Michelle Bachmann.
No.
What should I?
That's a tough, now you're talking tough case.
Yeah, and so I said to her, asked her to turn to a certain page in the book where there was a results volunteer who had a similar problem with his own member of Congress who had voted against famine aid for Ethiopia in 1985, and they adapted a prayer that a Houston results person had written for his tough congressman a year earlier, and they put their congressman in. I asked her to read it with Michelle Bachmann's name in. I'm going to read you the first and last sentence or something so you get a little flavor of it. It would go something like, "Thank you, God, for Michelle Bachmann. We know she's a good woman who wants to do right in the world. We know she struggles with the same problems we do, closing our hearts to those who don't agree with us." And the prayer goes on like that for about eight more lines. And they said in Atlanta, they said, "We would read this at our meeting and go, yeah, right. Yeah, sure." You know, but after a while, they said it sank in, and they would go to these sessions with their congressman. His name was Pat Swindoll, and he had these sessions called Chat with Pat sessions, and they renamed them Spat with Pat, because most people came and they had a bone to pick with the congressman, and they didn't get anywhere with them, and they'd come with a smile and a handshake and some information that made a difference. 2 years in, they go in, it would have been 87, to ask him to co-sponsor microfinance legislation. They bring in a video. He's sitting on his desk with his chin to his knees watching the video. They asked him to co-sponsor. He says, "I'd be delighted to do that." And he said, "You know, I have a local column in the local paper. Do you think you'd help write a column so we can educate the public?" And the person in the story in the book says, "All of a sudden, I'm ghostwriting for a man who voted against famine aid 2 years earlier. I think we're the only group that can get liberal John Lewis and conservative Pat Swindoll on the same legislation." So, you know, it's not a quick story. It's not a, you know, immediate turnaround story, but it is a transformation, really. And,
right.
You know, you can find that with groups that are committed to that.
And would you say that's kind of the key for being successful and making the change in government, is this kind of calling up and writing and visiting your members of Congress? Or your elected officials at the state level?
Yeah, and especially the face-to-face, and not face-to-face with the aide only, but face-to-face with the member and that kind of thing. Yeah, I think that's critical. Maybe you let me tell you one more story like this. I was on the Citizen Climate Lobby conference call maybe 3 years ago, and a woman gets on the phone. The guest speaker was Amory Lovins. He finished. And a woman gets on the phone. She said, "You, the executive director, said to us in December, 2 months earlier, that we're betting the farm on, relationships. Now go get a relationship with your member of Congress." And she said, "Well, our member of Congress at that time was Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader." And she said, "We couldn't get a meeting with him, but we got a meeting with his legislative director. And four of us decided to go, and we had two-hour preparatory meetings. And one of the four of us is a retired naval meteorologist. He brought more of the science. Another is an executive coach. He helped with the agendas. Another is Fred, and Fred is Jewish, and the congressman's Jewish, and Fred's known for his baking in the community. So he baked two challah breads, one for the congressman and one for the legislative director." He said, "We went into the meeting with a flip chart, and we asked the leg director, 'What are the congressman's values in the area of energy, economy, and environment? And we would write them up on the flip chart. And at the end of the meeting, the legislative director said, 'You're the most prepared group I've ever met with.'" And I told that story to the head of CARE, Save the Children, Oxfam. I said, "You know, I think if I ask a normal climate activist to meet with Eric Cantor or his leg director, I think they'd say, 'Now, which wall do you want me to bang my head against? Are you thinking that one, or you think this wall over here?'" And I was telling that story to the CEO of a U.S. environmental group with millions of stakeholders. I told the story. I didn't get to the wall-banging part. At the end of the first part of the story, looks at me and says, "You know, we wouldn't meet with the Eric Cantors of the world." And hands are cupped in front. It says, "We'd meet with those who are with us," and rocking hands back, "or those we feel we could move, but we wouldn't meet with the Eric Cantors of the world," which for me was, "Which wall do you want us to bang our head against?" kind of thing. And so, you know, I'll put my money on the groups that will meet with the Eric Cantors of the world.
Right, exactly. And we recently had as a guest on this show the Nuns on the Bus, and the Nun on the Bus leader was talking about her meeting with Eric Cantor. And kind of going right to the shared Catholic values.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think those conversations are really important, and you never know where they're going to lead.
Exactly.
I want to talk now about microcredit, because you have done more than almost anybody out there. Obviously, Muhammad Yunus is the big face worldwide of it, but you've done so much to make microcredit known. And you were in early and helped make it grow to what it is now. So can you talk a little bit about the microcredit summit campaign that you co-founded with the Finca founder John Hatch and Grameen Bank founder Muhammad Yunus?
Sure. You know, if you wouldn't mind, because there might be some listeners who aren't that familiar with it, and I could just tell briefly how Yunus came to starting Grameen Bank, for starters, because I think it's a good glimpse.
Yeah, well, and also just to say what microcredit is, because I think a lot of people don't know, and I believe it's like the single best way to reduce poverty worldwide. So, go ahead and explain it.
So, just briefly, he was a college professor at Chittagong University in Bangladesh. There was a famine in the country. He said, the economic theories in my textbook are very elegant, but they're not working in the village next to my campus. I'm going to go in the village and learn economics from the villagers. He actually later kind of said, you know, I was a young economics professor, and I doubting my own economic theories. I would say he was having a spiritual crisis. Mm-hmm. He goes in the village, 1976. He meets a woman who's making bamboo stools for sitting on. He asks her, how much money do you make every day? She says, I make 2 pennies a day profit. He said, how is that possible? It's a beautiful stool. Why you only make 2 pennies? She said, I don't have the money to buy the bamboo, so I borrow the money from a moneylender, a trader, on the condition that I sell the finished product back to him at a price he sets. The price he sets barely covers the cost of the bamboo. I make 2 pennies a day. He said, well, if you could sell it to anyone, could you make more than that? She said, I could, but I don't have the money to buy the bamboo. I have to keep going to the moneylender. So he had a student go around the village to find out who else was in the same boat, found 42 people who needed a grand total of $27, less than a dollar each, to pay off the moneylender, buy their raw materials, make whatever it is they made, and sell it to the highest bidder. So he lent 42 people a grand total of $27 from his pocket. And this woman went from 2 pennies a day to $1.25 a day, almost 40 years ago, immediately, because now she could sell her bamboo stools to the highest bidder. So, you know, we saw that this was a powerful, powerful intervention, and, you know, organized a microcredit summit in 1997 was the event itself. There were 2,900 people from 137 countries. And we set a goal of reaching 100 million of the world's poorest families, especially the women, with microfinance loans and other services. So that's the great news. The bad news, frankly, is this field has hit a fork in the road. And one fork keeps asking the question, what more can we do to improve the lives of our clients and help them improve their own lives? The other fork asks this question, what more can we do for our investors, the people who have invested in this microfinance bank? And so, you know, you're clear what fork of the road I'm excited about, which is the one that keeps wanting to focus first on improving the lives of the clients.
Right. It's such a great idea just to give a small short-term loan so that people can buy the materials or get the training or whatever it is they need to be able to become economically self-sufficient.
Absolutely.
Is there much microcredit happening in the U.S.? I mean, I know you had worked with the Finca, and they have a group here, but what's happening in the U.S. with microloans?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a group, AEO, which is the Association for Economic Opportunity, which is the association of these kinds of groups in the U.S. And so it's active here. Even Grameen has its own Grameen America, with branches in New York City and mm-hmm. San Francisco and Omaha, Nebraska, and elsewhere. So I don't know if the website's Microenterprise Works Worldwide, but if people look Microenterprise in USA, they will come up with AEO and learn more about that.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, obviously, you're going to have to do more than $47 to help people in the United States. But the concept, I think, is right, and I love it. And here again, I believe it's a concept that wherever you stand on the political spectrum, you can support the idea of having a small loan to help someone get the materials or training so they can become economically self-reliant.
When we were first working on this back in the mid to late 80s, there was a Republican congressman in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who had previously been the sheriff there, E. Clay Shaw, who called it a hand up, not a handout. And, it worked for both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, exactly. And I know you had, I think it was 1997, the big microcredit summit. And you did it. Didn't you do it annually for there? How long did you do it?
Well, I was with the summit. I helped organize 15 all around the world, in every continent but Antarctica. And now they're planning. They don't have a city yet. Their 18th microcredit summit coming at the end of this year or the beginning of next year.
Good.
And that would be microcreditsummit.org. People could find out more about that.
Yeah, and Hillary Clinton spoke at one of your early ones, and she's a big fan of the microcredit.
Big time, yeah.
Is this something you think government should get involved with or stay out of?
Well, I mean, it depends how they do it. They should stay out of it if they, you know, heavy-footed intervention kind of thing. That, you know, they should be involved in the most enabling way rather than, for example, the Bangladesh government has been a horror to Grameen Bank and Muhammad Yunus in the last 3 or 4 years. So they've gotten involved in the worst way lately. I think it would be really helpful if government saw the value and looked for, by talking to clients and the organizations, for how they could be most helpful, both protecting clients and moving this forward. But if they get involved in a heavy-handed way, they should stay out.
Right. And we just have a few minutes left. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your latest organization, the Center for Citizen Empowerment and Transformation.
Yeah, and so this I call it CSET, which is a center, as you said, for citizen empowerment and transformation. I coach nonprofit groups on training their members to create champions in Congress and the media for their cause. So I help them put structures of support together that really serve volunteers to get out of kindergarten and up to 3rd, 5th, 9th, 12th grade and beyond. And so the groups I'm working with, and people might want to look into them, I stopped recently, but I was working with citizensclimatelobby.org on climate change. So if someone's drawn to that, you ought to check them out. And I've been working with the Peace Alliance. That's peacealliance.org. And if you're concerned about issues around peace, you know, they have wonderful conference calls every month and action teams that you might check out or become a part of. So that's another of the groups that I'm involved in. I've just started more recently working with Friends Committee on national legislation, the Quaker Lobby. It's another great group. They're just about to launch at the end of June with their groups around the country. I've been working, and they're just in the earliest stages with their first groups in Chicago, New York, Nashville, and Miami with the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, which is testing this out too. So those are some of the groups that I'm working with that offer that. You remember my third main message was the challenge is finding an organization that provides a deeper structure of support and something far beyond kindergarten. And those are examples of the kinds of groups that people could look into.
Yeah, those sound great. And how can our listeners learn more about your work? Do you have a website that you recommend?
Yeah, my website is long. I'm good for long email addresses and websites. But it's citizenempowermentandtransformation.org. So www.citizenempowermentandtransformation.org.
Citizenempowermentandtransformation.org.
Yeah.
That sounds great. And is there anything you would recommend for our listeners? Like, you're obviously one of the world's top social entrepreneurs. What would you say to our listeners about, you know, what kind of action they could take to help make our situation better here in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I would start by taking a look at if you feel a little discouraged or more than a little discouraged, is there any of the areas I've just mentioned, results as global or domestic poverty? UNICEF, U.S. Fund for UNICEF is children around the world. Peace Alliance is peace domestically and globally. Friends Committee on National Legislation is focusing on ending the endless wars at the moment kind of thing. If any of those sing to you, look into those groups and seeing if you can somehow start getting connected to one of these structures of support that these organizations offer, or in a couple of cases are beginning to launch and beginning to offer. And get involved. Don't do it alone. Don't try and kind of do it by yourself. Find a little team of folks that can support each other, really.
That's great, and that's all the time we have. So, Sam Daly Harris, thank you so much for coming on the program and for all your important work.
Thank you.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Many thanks to our research associate, Dr. Judith Singleton. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.